From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, James Foley talks with us about directing the screen version of David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross. The film stars Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Alan Arkin, and Ed Harris. Also today, the singer who Ray Charles said had soul way back when people weren't using the word, singer Jimmy Scott. After a long absence from the music scene, he's making a comeback. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the making of Sgt. Pepper on the Disney Channel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council has voted to seize Iraq's oil assets in other countries to pay for war reparations, weapons inspections, and humanitarian activities in Iraq. Diplomats said the decision affects several hundred million dollars worth of assets and oil, mostly in the United States, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Iraq's foreign minister, Mohammed al-Shahaf, proposed allowing Iraq to raise the money by selling $4 billion worth of oil. Most of the 15 Security Council members rejected that proposal, and the vote on the resolution to seize the assets was 14 in favor, with China abstaining. President Bush has announced that the United States now supports a ban on Serbian combat planes over Bosnia and would agree to a United Nations request to enforce it if a no-fly zone is established. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
The administration had been sharply divided over banning flights over Bosnia, with the State Department pushing for it and the Pentagon urging caution. Officials at the Pentagon were concerned the ban could lead to greater military involvement. The ban on Serbian combat flights will now be taken up at the United Nations, perhaps as early as next week. With more and more reports of Serbian atrocities and growing concern over a potentially deadly winter, the pressure on the United States to do more has been considerable. The United States has not provided ground troops to protect relief convoys in Bosnia, but President Bush announced today he's offered to transport those troops who are moving in. He said he would also contribute an additional $12 million to help refugees from the former Yugoslavia, and the administration plans to push the UN to tighten sanctions against Serbia. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Negotiators for President Bush and Governor Bill Clinton have apparently reached an agreement for a series of four debates. The biggest obstacle, the timing of the debates, has been resolved with just a few minor details still to work out. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
Negotiations continue today with a formal announcement on the agreement expected tomorrow. But sources familiar with the planning say the debate over the debates is over. There will be three debates between the presidential candidates and one between the vice presidential candidates, beginning October 11th and concluding October 19th. One of the presidential face-offs will be conducted by a single moderator, which was recommended by a bipartisan commission and favored by Governor Clinton. Another will be run by a panel of journalists, which is what President Bush wanted. And a third debate will use a mixed format, which one source said could involve questions from an audience. Independent candidate Ross Perot will be invited to participate, and his running mate, James Stockdale, will be asked to join the vice presidential debate. This is Anthony Brooks in Washington.
Stock prices fell to their lowest level in almost 6 months today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 54 points to close at 3,200.6. This is NPR. Democrats and Republicans are blaming one another for the Senate's failure to pass an education reform bill this session. Senate Democrats failed to cut off debate on the bill, effectively allowing opponents to filibuster until the Senate adjourns next week. Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy, who supports the bill, said that Republicans blocked it because it didn't include President Bush's school choice plan. Republicans argued that the bill would simply mean more bureaucracy and more federal control over local schools. In Italy, tens of thousands of workers demonstrated in Rome against government austerity measures, but the rally was disrupted by left-wing militants who fought with police. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports.
300 demonstrators were arrested and 20 people injured in clashes with riot police today in Rome. Police fired tear gas and charged demonstrators with nightsticks after a group of about 150 left-wing militants disrupted the protest rally called by Italy's major trade unions. The Rome police chief said the troublemakers had nothing to do with organized labor and had tried to turn the rally into a violent protest. The demonstration climaxed 2 weeks of strikes directed at keeping pressure on the government of Prime Minister Giuliano Amato, which has proposed drastic cuts in Italy's generous health care and pension systems. Hundreds of thousands of public administration workers stayed off the job today throughout the country, closing schools, offices, and paralyzing transportation. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
The Bank of England responded strongly today to U.S. allegations that it was negligent in failing to reveal or pursue criminal activities at the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. The allegations were contained in a Senate subcommittee report released yesterday. Bank of England officials released a statement today saying that the Senate investigators had never taken evidence from the bank or asked to check any facts. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Salesmen who don't have a good product to sell rely on persuasive language and lies. David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross, is about a group of men selling bad real estate to broke customers. These guys have lots of verbal tricks to get customers to buy. They also use their sales techniques on their boss and on each other to try to get the best customers or the best leads. It's a perfect story for David Mamet, who has a great ear for the music of colloquial speech. Glengarry Glen Ross has been adapted into a film, which opened nationally today. Mamet wrote the screenplay. My guest, James Foley, directed the film. He assembled a fine cast, including Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Ed Harris, and Alan Arkin. In this scene, Ed Harris and Alan Arkin are talking about what they could do if they had good leads.
You said a fellow, you're saying, could take those leads and sell them to Graft?
The leads to Graft, yes. I was saying, yeah, a guy could take, like anything else, it seems to me, that is negotiable, a guy could sell them.
How do you know he'd buy them?
Because I worked for him.
You didn't talk to him?
No. What do you mean? Did I talk to him about this?
Yeah. Are you just talking about this, or were you just talking about it?
Yeah, we're just speaking about it.
Speaking about it as an idea.
Yes.
We're not actually talking about it.
No.
Talking about it as a...
No.
As a robbery.
As a robbery? No. Hey.
So all this, you didn't actually call Graf. You didn't talk to him.
Not actually, no.
You didn't?
No, not actually.
Did you?
What did I say?
What did you say?
I said not actually. Fuck you care, George. We're just talking.
We are?
Yes.
Because it's a crime.
Robbery. That's right. It is a crime. It's also very safe.
You're actually talking about this.
That's right.
You're going to steal the leads.
Have I said that?
Are you?
Did I say that?
Did you talk to Graf?
What did I say?
What did he say?
What did he say? He'd buy him.
We recently previewed Glengarry Glen Ross in Philadelphia at a benefit screening for WHYY, and we invited Foley to talk with us in the theater after the film. Foley also directed At Close Range and After Dark, My Sweet. Thanks for coming. It's great to have you here. The language, as we all heard, is not exactly naturalistic. It's a really kind of stylized, like hyper-realist form of colloquial language. When you're reading the script and figuring out what you want to get out of it as the director, how does a Mamet script read different from what you're used to seeing as a script?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good, which is very it's very different. And I think the most important thing, when I read this screenplay, I certainly was aware of what it was, and I really began to read it with some trepidation, like, why do I want to make a film out of this Pulitzer Prize-winning play? It was not something I ever saw myself doing. And so I read it with, not likely. But what really surprised me was that the reading of it seemed much more emotionally accessible than my memory of the play. I had thought when I saw the play that it really appealed to me sort of from the neck up and was an interesting intellectual, philosophical, black, humorous sort of experience. But reading the screenplay, for some reasons that I later analyzed for myself, it really opened up a whole other level of an emotional accessibility to the characters that had not been evident for me on stage.
Did you want people to read the lines naturalistically, or were you looking for something else?
No, that was very important, because I became aware early on that there was a real danger that actors could get into with language like this, where they get seduced by the superficial level of gratification that comes from just saying good dialogue that's written in a rhythmic way. Because if you just memorize the lines and say them fast, they sound good. And so one could get convinced that it actually meant something. And that actually happened a lot when we had actors come in to read, and some really heavyweight actors had come in and read. And they made a big mistake by sort of having prepared in that superficial way. And so it was flashy and entertaining, but totally boring to me. What I was much more interested in was getting actors who had an interior emotional life that was easily accessible. And I felt as if the technical aspects of being able to fire off this rapid dialogue was something that would come later, but it was secondary to me to this internal life, and an internal life specific to cinema actors.
The casting is terrific in the film, but it seems to me you've brought together actors with really different kinds of acting styles. You have Jack Lemmon, who's a kind of like naturalistic actor, and Al Pacino's Al Pacino, you know.
I was going to sit and wait to hear you get an adjective for each guy.
Yeah. But Ed Harris is kind of chameleon-like in a way, and he can really like blend into a role. But they're, I don't know, like Lemmon's of a different generation than a lot of actors in there, both in terms of his age, but also in terms of his style. And I was wondering if you consciously picked people with different acting styles and what it was like to work with people who, it seems to me, probably take really different approaches to their characters.
Yeah, there was certainly no intention to deliberately pick people with different styles. It was really, I mean, Al and I literally sat down and made a list of who we thought were the best living actors, without even regards to what parts they could play, how old they were. Who do we think is great? And the list isn't that long, you know, when you sit down and just say who's the best. And we started from that idea and wound up with these guys. And it's very true that they all have very different styles of acting, and it was a great fun for me when, particularly when they were all in the scene together, and you know, you say cut, and then you need to go out and speak to each one of them, and I'd find myself instinctually sort of speaking an entirely different language to each one, which was nice, because it made me sort of really expand my own idea of what it means to be a director. And you know, for me, the most important thing is to do what needs to be done rather than what you want to do.
So you needed to speak a different language to each of the actors?
Totally, yes.
Okay, and so what would you tell Jack Lemmon as opposed to Al Pacino as opposed to
instance,
Ed Harris?
Well, for instance, Jack Lemmon will speak very clearly about the thing quite literally, the thing being what's going on at the moment that... And perhaps the most telling thing is that when Jack would talk about the character, he would say he would say, I think he's feeling this because of this and blah, 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 and say whole articulate sentences. Al would never speak like that, because first of all, he would say I, referring to something, but he would never talk about any kind of singular idea or notion. And something that I understand very much, because if you articulate a single idea that's happening, then you might try, you know, you might sort of glom onto that in too much of a specific way rather than letting all the contradictions and ambivalences that might naturally come out. So he's very reluctant to identify any one particular feeling, and even reluctant to finish a sentence. But I began to understand very well what he was talking about, and I agreed with him. So our communication was more like him saying, I think, you know, maybe, you know, and I'd say, yeah, right, more so, blah, blah, blah. And we somehow did it, and even to the point where it got to, you know, where once we had done enough takes where we both felt like we really had it, we would always do one crazy one, and that's, we would just call it a crazy one, because to try something just that was a stupid idea. But it's amazing how many of the crazy ones are in there.
When you were rehearsing for this, did you bring in any real salesmen to give a sense of how they do it, to talk about their spiels?
Yeah, we did. Somehow somebody dug up a real guy who came in, who was great. He read the script and was thrilled by it and was very proud that we were making a film about him. and he really was very, he was a good sort of visitor because he thought it was very authentic down to every detail, and that gave everybody encouragement. What was interesting about him was that he had no consciousness whatsoever that there was any irony about the situation. He just thought it was a very good story about these guys and showed how sort of clever they were and stuff like that. And he thought it was quite glamorous. And that was very good because the guys at this point during the rehearsals really needed to connect to that, you know, because they needed to, of course, you know, not see anything ironic about it themselves and, you know, let that take care of it and had to become totally and find some pride in being one of these guys because, you know, they all are, particularly Ricky Roma being the top of the heap. You know, he was very proud, Al, of his pinky ring. And he was always looking at it and happy with his suit that cost $2,000. And he would, like, you know, like he does, get into it.
So what did this guy sell who you brought in, and why did you bring him in?
To be honest, I don't know where what rock people found him under, but I know he was real because when I sort of teased him a little bit about perhaps he was, you know, involved in something like, you know, quasi-illegal about maybe what he did in misrepresenting the land, because he had brought himself right up to that point in sort of showing off about how he had really, you know, scammed people and got people to pay much more than the market value of what he was selling. But when I sort of teased him about it, he then got kind of a little bit weird and defensive because all of a sudden he sort of came back to reality and realized that he was feeling very comfortable because the guys were all sort of around him and sort of giving him, and his big movie stars are paying attention to this guy. So he was like saying more than he wanted to, and then all of a sudden he realized how far he was going and he backed up.
So was it useful to have him there?
Yeah, I think very much. I think if nothing else, to see that a real person existed and that he was, as I say, that he had a sense of real pride in himself.
Now, are you an easy mark for salesmen?
Oh, God, yeah, the worst. I mean, even before this, I could not buy a car. This is so pathetic, but I had to ask a friend of mine to go with me, and I, like, stood outside and everything to go in. And of course, because I have this, not that I'm so such a good guy or moral or anything, but when I'm negotiating with somebody and they want a certain price and I want to pay less, I start thinking, well, this guy has got a family and I'm a movie director. I probably have more money than he does. Why should I do this? And that's not a good position to have. But ever since the movie, it has been one real big effect on me. I cannot look at somebody as at a salesman. I mean, even going into a Radio Shack and somebody tries to help me, I just got to leave. So it's made me very, very uncomfortable with that stuff.
Well, are you a more assertive shopper now?
Yeah, I just can't. Anything that has to be negotiated, I don't want any negotiated prices. But this has always been sort of a problem. I mean, it happens in the smallest kind of ways. I just went to a film festival, you know, in Venice and stuff, and you get treated extremely nicely, and they give you, you're flying over first class, and everyone's taking care of you. But then it's sort of like you go in there, and you don't know, like, are your extras being paid for? So can you, like, take a lot of stuff from the mini bar, you know? And I'm like Mr. Frugal and stuff, and I don't want to drink with the mini bar, but I don't have the nerve to ask anybody when they're going to pay it, so I just don't use the mini bar. It's really sad.
Well, here's a question about money. Al Pacino, very, very highly paid actor, right? I bet this is not like a multi-megabuck kind of movie. There's no special effects. It's not a big glitz film. You know, it's a serious film. I'm not saying it's not funny, but you know what I mean. So were you able to pay him his going rate, or did he take a cut because he particularly liked the movie?
Oh, yeah. No, no one got paid anywhere near their going rate. People got paid very little. But what
it's
was
good you didn't drink from that mini bar then.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I really found that became a very a good and positive thing because there's a weird, perverse thing in Hollywood that the more you're paid, it's like the less motivated you are to actually do the work because somehow it's, you know, it becomes so much about the externals of it that the actual content becomes meaningless. But in this case, since nobody was getting money, the focus was very clear. The only reason anybody was doing it was because of what the script was. And it was amazing, and it was a real Pollyanna experience because nobody ever was late. Nobody ever asked to leave early. Nobody ever asked to change the schedule. People would hang out on the set in between takes to the extent where, you know, that never happens in movies. You know, all the ADs have to go hunt down the actor, drag him in. And in this case, they had to ask the actors, could you please, you know, go away for a while so we can do our work.
We're listening to a conversation with film director James Foley that we recorded in Philadelphia after a screening of his new movie, Glengarry Glen Ross. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Foley, director of the new film, Glengarry Glen Ross. You know, in the movie, all the actors have to sell really crummy real estate. They have really bad leads. The real estate isn't good, and the people who they're supposed to be selling it to don't have the money and they don't have the interest. I wonder if, like, getting assigned to or volunteering to make a movie that you don't really believe in would be the equivalent of what these guys are up against, selling stuff that isn't good.
That's very interesting. I think exactly that. I have thought about that because I had one experience where I did that, and it was hell. I directed an episode of Twin Peaks, and it was in the second season. And they asked me in the first season, and I couldn't do it. So they asked me at the beginning of the second season, and I said yes, and I made this commitment, and thinking it would be like the first season. By the time I got there, David Lynch had totally abandoned the thing. The scripts, he was not putting input into the writing of the script. He was off in Tokyo selling his art. And there I was stuck with this script that had nothing, that was like faux Lynch, you know. It was like a bunch of people sitting around sort of making believe they were David Lynch. And I'm stuck with this script, and I was horrifying. Nothing was more terrible in my life because you don't know what to do. I don't know where to put the camera. I don't know what to say to the actors. I just want to go home. And it was really, really an awful experience. Luckily, it was only 4 or 5 days, you know, one episode. But it gave me a lesson about that very thing, that there's no way I could get through making a film that I didn't, even if delusional, didn't think had the potential to be good.
Which episode was it?
I'm going to rent it out. I don't know what the name of it is, the number, but it's an episode where Sherilyn Fenn is being seduced by a guy wearing a cowboy hat. I didn't even know who his character was exactly, but he came in and went out. Oh, and there was a weasel that there was a fashion show going on, and a weasel gets loose, and everyone starts screaming and stuff.
Did you watch it back on television, and did it look as bad as it felt when you were doing it?
No, because you know, you have a couple of beers, and you turn the sound down on loud, and you think, well, it's okay, and then music comes in, bum-bong, bum-bong, and it kind of looks like Twin Peaks. But in retrospect, I do think definitely that this is conventional wisdom, that it just fell apart in the second year.
When you're directing a movie in which all the actors in it are playing the part of somebody who's very aggressive and in selling, are they that way when you're trying to direct them? Was it intimidating at all because they're all playing these really manipulative people who have their raps and they have their ways?
No, it was, which has been my experience really on every film, that actors really, really want to be directed and they want interaction.
Even the big stars.
Oh, well, that's what's great is that, you know, it doesn't matter who it is. You know, they just, and I really think the best actors, I mean, you know, like Alan and the rest of the guys, are so interested in trying anything that they very much want a reaction. And what was interesting, as you said before, is that each person wants that reaction in a different way. I mean, some people don't want you to say certain things, and other people do want you to say certain things. And that's the fun part, is this instinctual idea of figuring out what it is that they need at what time, including sometimes being a little bit pushing a little bit more than they might want at the time. But there's a mutual understanding of what you're doing.
Who did you push?
Oh, I push them all at different times in different ways, you know, but it's just, it's all different how you push them. Because sometimes pushing just means, let's do another take right now, really fast. And they go, well, wait. And you say, no, it has to be really fast because, you know, we're really in, and you sort of discombobulate them on purpose because you feel like perhaps we're getting into a kind of a rut and it's getting too precious and people are getting too conscious of what they're saying and you want to. And I've taken to do weird things like, you know, I demand silence all the time from everybody on the crew and everything, and I'm always barking about that. And then I get total silence, and then when it's ready to go, I scream, cut, not cut, what do I scream? Action. One of those two things. Just scream, action, like as loud as I can, which is like really startling, and then the actor's got to start saying his line. But it's sort of like sometimes you see them standing there, and they're getting too much into a plan of what they're going to do, and you want them to forget their plan and let whatever happens, gonna happen. And so it's all different things of doing. I actually threw a fit once, a fake fit, yelling at somebody on the crew just to, you know, get the actors out of their lethargy and change the mood, the electricity on the set.
Was the crew member in on the fact that this was a fake fit?
Yes. Yes, I made sure I did that.
So what were you throwing the fit about?
I was throwing the fit about people talking, because I'm famous for throwing fits, real fits, because people will not shut up. So I asked this one guy to talk, right, so then I could turn around and scream at him. It worked.
Did it get what you wanted?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So what did it get you doing this?
It got me the actors being more immediate, that the thing you always have to fight, you know, on take 11 is that people doing the exact same thing, and it begins to become, they begin to remember that they just did it before, and so there's a repetition, an inevitable repetition. So it's almost like this feeling you have, you know, when all of a sudden in the middle of the day, the weather changes dramatically, and it goes from being sunny and calm, and then wind is coming, and you feel your whole mood and everything change, and you've got to sort of change the weather on the set sometimes.
You're friends with Sean Penn, and you've directed him in a movie. Is it harder to direct a friend than an actor who you admire and you don't know at all, or vice versa, or no correlation?
I don't think I would ever start to do a movie with the lead actors. I didn't have some kind of personal relationship with them and know them well enough. I mean, my litmus test is I have to be able to make fun of them and make fun of who they are and of their fame. It's very important to sort of feel as if that's a joke, and no, we don't care about that. And in Sean's case, I knew him a lot. You know, we were very good friends. And it creates a very positive opportunity because you know somebody very well and becomes very sort of private, and you can be very specifically emotional. And there's just that thing that friends have where you don't have to have any kind of formality about it. The flip side, however, is something that always interests me, but I've gotten a lot better about, is that you have your own emotional life that's going on during the movie, and sometimes you get in a position where you have to, it's not equal, because the actor is doing what they're doing, and they're using their emotions, and in a certain way you are in a very, you know, in emotional movies, you're creating an environment where they can express their emotions, and that's the most important thing. And their emotions are more important than your emotions during that time, because, you know, you got to get on with it, and you do that. And sometimes, you know, you get your feelings hurt, but you can't, you know, stop the movie because somebody hurt your feelings. But it happens to be like a very good friend of yours. And so in different times, you know, that can be something where my own persecution complex can like well up, and I feel like, why is God punishing me by making me do this? But there's less of that the more movies I do.
Listen, it's been wonderful to have you here, and it's been wonderful to get the kind of insights that you could give us into this film and into filmmaking in general. So thank you very, very much for being here.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
James Foley directed the new film Glengarry Glen Ross. We spoke at a movie theater in Philadelphia after a screening of the film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jimmy Scott has influenced a lot of singers, including Frankie Lyman, Nancy Wilson, and Stevie Wonder. Quincy Jones used to play with Scott and said of his singing, "Jimmy used to tear my heart out every night." Scott has had a troubled life, and his career has been punctuated with long absences from recording and performing. Now he's making a comeback. He has a record on the jazz charts. Maybe you saw him on the last episode of Twin Peaks. Coming up, we talk with Jimmy Scott. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new documentary about the Beatles called The Making of Sgt. Pepper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved a resolution that calls for seizure of assets from Iraqi oil sales, most of them in the U.S. The money is to compensate victims of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait and to pay for UN weapons inspections and aid to dissident groups. The money includes funds from oil sales, which were frozen after sanctions were placed on Iraq. Iraqi crude oil in pipelines in Saudi Arabia and Turkey is also affected. The High Court of Russia has taken steps to prevent former President Gorbachev from leaving Russia until he agrees to testify in the current court battle over last year's banning of the activities of the Communist Party. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The Russian Constitutional Court took today's action after Gorbachev this week defied the court's order to appear in the case testing the legality of Russian President Boris Yeltsin's banning of the party a year ago. Gorbachev called the trial a comedy and charged that the court was trying to make him a scapegoat. In open court yesterday, Russia's chief judge called Gorbachev's remarks insulting. And then today, according to the Russian news agency Itar Tass, the court asked both the Russian Foreign Ministry and the Security Ministry to prevent Gorbachev's departure from Russian territory. Gorbachev has been traveling widely in recent months. Just a few days ago, he returned from Germany, and he was planning to travel again, reportedly to South Korea, on Monday. The Russian news agency reported that both ministries indicated they would stop Gorbachev from leaving the country until he testifies. No word yet from Gorbachev himself in response. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Congress has declined to send an education bill to the White House as the Senate blocked passage of a measure calling for funding of school reform efforts. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The bill called for higher academic standards, mandated smaller classes, loosened federal regulation, and gave parents more choice in selecting a public school for their children. President Bush has proposed all of these measures in his education plan, but Democrats in the House earlier this week and again today in the Senate rejected the president's request for vouchers for parents who would rather send their kids to private or parochial schools. So Senate Republicans today said the bill was not worth supporting. Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah called the bill the beginning of a federal takeover of the public schools and denounced it as a political exercise. The bill's public school choice plan was very similar to the one presidential candidate Bill Clinton is proposing. Congress will now have to take education legislation up when it convenes next year. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
President Bush says that the U.S. supports a no-fly zone over Bosnia and, if called upon by the U.N. to enforce it, would do so. The president says that Western allies will endeavor to get a U.N. Security Council resolution approved, calling for a banning of all flights over Bosnia unless authorized by the U.N. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials dropped nearly 54 points. This is NPR News. The Pentagon says that there had been no scheduled firing of missiles planned during NATO exercises yesterday. The aircraft carrier Saratoga launched two missiles, hitting a Turkish ship and killing at least five people, including the captain. A three-admiral board has been convened to see what happened. The firing occurred in the Aegean Sea about 8 miles offshore. The Pentagon says the two ships were about 3 miles apart when the missiles were fired and one hit the Turkish ship. On Capitol Hill, Congress has again failed to override a presidential veto of a measure to overturn a so-called gag rule that places restrictions on abortion counseling. The Senate voted to override, but the House did not. NPR's Paz Cohen reports.
Although the Senate yesterday voted to override the president's veto, the House fell 10 votes short of the number needed to do so. The gag rule, which took effect yesterday, denies government money to federally funded clinics where anyone other than a doctor offers abortion counseling. Most federally funded clinics do not have a doctor on staff. The gag rule is still facing another challenge. A federal district court judge has indicated he will rule soon on a new petition to stop its implementation. His decision is expected to be appealed. The Supreme Court upheld the gag rule last year when it ruled on a challenge to the original proposal made by then-President Reagan in 1988. I'm Pas Cohen in Washington.
Also in Washington, the government said today that factory orders dropped again in August for the second month in a row. Economists had expected a rise of 0.2% in new orders to factories, but instead they fell 1.9%. It was the biggest drop since last December and leaves the smallest inventory in 3.5 years. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1988, The Village Voice featured a long profile of the jazz singer Jimmy Scott, who had been long absent from the music scene. Scott was very popular in the 50s and influenced such singers as Nancy Wilson, Frankie Lyman, and Stevie Wonder. But, the article said, in spite of his influence, Jimmy remains an invisible man in black music history. His two greatest albums, long out of print, don't even have his picture on the cover. Jimmy performs on One Night in Birdland, yet his vocal is credited to a woman. Rumors swirl around this singer. Some say he's a junkie. Others insist his masculinity is a fraud, just another gimmick to get over a very idiosyncratic female vocalist. Well, this profile, written by Jimmy McDonough, helped revive interest in Jimmy Scott, and now Scott has a new record which is high on the jazz charts. He just performed in New York and sings tomorrow night in Philadelphia. Before we meet Jimmy Scott, let's listen to the title track from his new album, All the Way.
When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you. All the way. Happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way. Taller than the tallest tree. That's how it's got to go. How deep it goes, if it's real. When somebody needs you.
When you started singing, were there a lot of listeners who assumed you were a woman?
Yes. Yes, I had people play the records after doing them with Lionel Hampton. And they'd have contests on the programs to have the public tell them who it was. And many people called women's names. And finally, it was announced that it was not a woman, but it was myself whom was singing with Lionel Hampton at the time. And then I've even had people in the public question, is he really a guy, or is that a woman standing there, you know? So those things have happened, you know. But being in the business, you learn early in the business that opinions are not supposed to affect the work you do in public, you know.
Nevertheless, though, how self-conscious were you when people assumed that you were a woman? Were you self-conscious about the pitch of your voice?
Not really. There were times I could say later in the career that I wished that my voice would be deeper for materials that I might have wanted to select to do. But that's the style of my voice. There's nothing I could do about the height of my voice. And so I learned to deal with it.
What kind of song are you thinking of that you felt you couldn't do?
There were many tunes that were down, like Eckstein was doing, Cottage for Sale. I know now, that was early in the career, yes, but I know now that, hey, even with my own style of singing, even with the height of my voice, I could still today create a style for those particular songs.
I want to play one of your early records. Mm-hmm. This is from 1955. This is your first session for Savoy. And this song is Don't Cry Baby. Mm-hmm. And Bud Johnson's on tenor saxophone. Charles Mingus is on bass. Let's hear it. This is a great recording from 1955. Jimmy Scott. Something I read about this session was that Mingus, who was featured on bass, walked out during the session. What happened?
Well, you know, one of the things, of all guys, to be confused about a singer singing behind the beat, it was quite surprising to know that he was affected by my style of singing. Because I do have a delayed behind the beat, you know, expression when I sing a song, and that was one of the things he just says he couldn't cope with it. This guy ain't singing on time. It's, you know, what are we doing here? You know, and he was a very strict, arrogant guy about that. You know,
Jimmy Scott is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Singer Jimmy Scott is my guest. He has a new album called All the Way. Some of the people who were influenced a lot by your singing style include Nancy Wilson and Frankie Lyman. Did you hear yourself in them when they started to record? Did you notice the influence?
Well, you know, it was mentioned to me. I didn't pay specific attention to what it was like or... But it was related to me by others. Oh, man, Nancy sings that song just like you would have sang it. Or Frankie Valli, he's using those high notes just like you would do them, or something like that, you know. I came up in the business when artists, like vocalists, shared a lot of music with each other. Therefore, I could understand that we could pick up things from each other. And, of course, Nancy's was surprising because her parents have often told me how when they would bring the records I'd do home, she would get herself, lock herself in her room and just listen over and over and over.
Were you flattered? But when people sounded like you, or did you feel like they were stealing your style?
No, I thought it was great, and I thought also, being that I came up in an era like I did, and people did share material with each other, I kind of felt good about the fact that if they were saying that that person sounded somewhat like me, or they felt that they got something from what I did, if they did it well, I could. That was a compliment.
One of your big breaks was in 1948 when Lionel Hampton asked you to sing with the band. And after he hired you, Hampton changed your age from 25 to 17. Why did he do that?
I don't know whether you remember, but a Sugar Child Robinson.
Right. He was a dancer,
pianist,
wasn't he?
Yeah, a little pianist and a boogie-woogie player. This little kid used to play boogie-woogie in the piano. He was out of, I think he was, if I'm not mistaken, he was out of Detroit, out of the Michigan area. And Hamp had picked him up. Well, he had done great with Sugar Child. He had toured him all over, and he was quite successful with it. Well, he was into a thing of giving young persons opportunities. I looked young, and by looking young, he wanted that young appearance on stage. And I think that that's really the gimmick that was being used, you know?
Well, how'd you feel about that?
Well, it didn't work too well with me. Because, all right, okay, I'm a grown man, you know? So I couldn't develop an attitude of childhood as far as being in the public, you know? And it didn't work.
Well, also, I can imagine, you know, a lot of 25, you want to meet women, too, and if you're...
Well, see, one thing about it, I had the first wife.
Oh, you were married already.
I was married already, you know. And we were separated, but I was married, really. That means I was dating women, you know.
Right.
And how could you go around dating women and the public see you with women and... whatnot, they say, oh, that kid? Because I had many people tell me, get out of a bar, because they thought I was a kid, you know?
How tall were you then?
I was about 4'11". Yeah, about 4'11".
So that must have made it even more difficult.
Yes, because I didn't start to growing the size I am now until, I was darn near 40 years old.
That's really unusual, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. But that was a glandular and a hormonal deficiency that caused that, the syndrome thing that caused that. And then when it did react, then I started growing.
Were you taking any kind of hormonal pills when you started to grow?
No.
So it's just like your hormonal balance changed?
Like, yes, yes. It was just like a delayed thing, you know?
So how tall are you now?
I'd say 5'10". Say 5'8", really. Yeah, about 5'8".
Now, when you were undergoing this hormonal change, it didn't affect your voice at all?
Not at all.
Were you glad that it didn't affect your voice?
Afterwards, yes. After I realized just what was happening, I said, well, thank God. It didn't affect, but now it did make it stronger. I project stronger. If you notice the old records, they're much lighter, vocally much lighter in sound than the records that I'm doing today.
Now, how is your new record affecting your career? Are you performing more now?
Yes, I see more prospects for performing now. I'll say that. And I have been doing... I'm doing more the kind of dates that I'd like to do. You see...
Not playing seedy bars, playing
right.
Classy
I mean,
places.
Before it was a necessity to work. Okay, now this enables and makes it possible for me to do less of that tight thing. Of course, I had strayed from it anyway. I had gotten to the point where, hey, if I gotta go in one of the dives to do a gig, no good. And I began working for small organizations and doing concerts and things like that for them in their promotions and things when they wanted fundraisers and things like that. Then I started performing for little organizations.
What's the worst part about performing in a dive?
Well, most of it is that the people there are not really conscious of the music
mm-hmm.
that you're trying to portray. They're there for the drink and a hell of a good time. And they ignore completely what's going on where the entertainment is concerned. So that begins to get awkward with you, you know, when you go out there and you do have a purpose to your work. Okay? All right, if I was a rock and roll singer or a noise maker as far as my performance, it wouldn't matter, I'm sure, because that's what they called for. But seeing the dives and things, hey.
Did you ever feel like you would never record again, that you had made your last record?
No. No, I never felt like that it would be the end. I know I've had statements made, well, who in the heck wants to hear a 60-year-old singer? That statement was made. It was heartening, you know, because you say, well, hey, why should a guy feel like that about it? But then, I mean, the answer was there. They're listening to Frank Sinatra. They're listening to Tony Bennett. They can listen to Jimmy Scott, too.
Jimmy Scott's new recording is All the Way. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, today NPR's Ann Garrels will have a report on the Bush administration's support for a ban on Serbian combat flights over Bosnia. And Linda Wertheimer is in Southern California. She'll be filing from there on how older Americans are feeling about the presidential election, about some of the issues that concern them, issues like health care, crime, and living on a fixed income. And today at the Library of Congress, Irving Berlin's three daughters donated 750,000 pieces of their father's papers and songs and notes. And we'll hear from Irving Berlin's daughters. They'll be talking about how their father composed his music.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As part of a month-long salute to the Beatles, the Disney Channel is presenting a new documentary called The Making of Sgt. Pepper. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the album's release. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
I didn't expect much from this documentary because I didn't think there was anything left about Sgt. Pepper that I didn't already know. I love the Beatles. Still do. And like most people who do, I know a lot about them. So a lot of what is in this documentary, The Making of Sgt. Pepper, is old news. Yes, Good Morning was inspired by a cornflakes ad. Yes, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was originally the title of a drawing by John Lennon's son Julian, not a code phrase for LSD. And Paul wasn't dead, and John is. Stop the presses. Even the surviving Beatles, who were interviewed independently for this show, don't have much left to say. They go on the record, no doubt, as a favor to George Martin, who's the executive producer of this special. Martin is the guy who also produced all the Beatles albums except for Let It Be. And on this occasion, it's Martin, not the Beatles, who is the star. and who makes this documentary something really special. He doesn't just stroll down memory lane. He sits there at the audio console, playing back tapes from the Sgt. Pepper sessions and splitting the original four-track recordings. The first time he does this is with Strawberry Fields Forever, the first song recorded during the Sgt. Pepper sessions. It was released as a single and never made the album, but Martin identifies the elements that made it the test case for the multi-layered experimentation that would make Sgt. Pepper such a landmark.
Double track voices on 3 and 4, but with percussion as well on 3.
Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever.
Suor Mandela. An Indian instrument that George had brought back, like a kind of harp. They have a marvelous effect. Backward cymbal on track 1. Always sounds like Russian language to me. Brass stabs and so on, and with the cello. But underlying it all, this wonderful rhythm section.
Every song gets that same treatment, and every demonstration brings out something new and exciting.
Sgt. Pepper, the opening track of the album. Really a good old-fashioned rocker. Starts off with applause, or rather atmosphere noise, from a recording I made up in Cambridge with Beyond the Fringe crowd, Dudley Moore and company. And this super electric guitar, and tied together beautifully by a great rock voice from Paul. Listen to this. You've got sawdust in his voice there. And then a bit of classical work, bringing in 4 French horns. Always there's the audience punctuating the whole thing. And then the chorus, singing the chorus.
We hope you will enjoy the show. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Sit back and let the evening go.
I love this stuff. If you're a true Beatles fan, you will too. It'll have you putting on the album and the headphones all over again.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. The Making of Sgt. Pepper airs again on the Disney Channel tomorrow night. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Our conversation with James Foley was produced with Art Ellis and Kathy Ball. I'm Terry Gross.
To do to save his life, call his wife in. Nothing to say but what a day. How's your
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Doris. He's written a new children's book about a Native American family in 1492, just before Columbus. Doris is a Native American anthropologist and a writer. His earlier book, The Broken Cord, is about fetal alcohol syndrome, which his adopted son suffered from. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.